The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. On this week's podcast, we've got a very special guest.
Now, how do we describe the gentleman who's just been on the screen?
He's a smee.
Nearly flubbed.
He's a smeeg.
Those magnificent men in their flying machines, they go hop diddly up, up, they go down diddly down, down. Down diddly down, down? Oh, I hope not. Welcome to Scrap Heap Challenge.
Bye, work!
I should have invited you in.
Well, I was really annoyed. I'd love to come in and see all the new, where you do all the studio and there's all that stuff.
There's a chuffing great multimedia hub.
Wow.
Where we do all our audio and video.
It's Jemima Kiss from The Guardian, who I listen to on Guardian Tech Weekly.
Yes.
That is, of course, Robert Llewellyn, famous as Crichton in sci-fi series Red Dwarf and as the presenter of Scrap Heap Challenge, amongst many other things. Robert is joining me in the studio to explain why he takes famous and not famous friends for a ride in his car, films them, and then releases them on the web. That sounds slightly dodgy, if you ask me.
It's very, very suspicious.
Do you tell them? Are we sure that this is legal? I'm not.
They do know that that's what I'm doing.
Good.
When I turn up outside their house, they have guessed.
It's called stalking. You've got the infrared cameras. Well, the result is Carpool, an online phenomenon that offers personal insight into the nonsense people will talk when they're in the car. Surprisingly intimate. So welcome. Thank you very much coming along.
Thank you for having me.
We've also got Mike Butcher from TechCrunch. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hello there, Alex. Very well. How are you?
Yeah. I'm very well. Actually, I'm not. I'm completely insane. I just got off a plane this morning, so it is currently some other time, some other continent for me right now. In fact, it may even be another day.
Are you in a sort of time traveller?
I'm a time warping.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this week, I'd like to start with the evolution of the world that we live in. The Sony Walkman, sadly, dearly departed. It's been discontinued. It was an iconic piece of technology that transformed the noisy boomboxes that people used to walk down the street with into a very personal and a very private musical system. Now that it's gone, though, Robert, what are your favourite memories?
Oh, I do remember mine very fondly. I had one that you could record with. I think it was kind of like a Sony Walkman Pro. It was black, and it had a stereo microphone on the top. But it would also record its own operation. So if you were talking quietly, you'd also hear, which was the little engine driving the little tape round.
Oh, that's very evocative, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was very, very
organic.
Yeah, so I tried to do radio programs on it, and I had friends who had a Bang & Olufsen stereo with big speakers, and they had all those sort of stuff, but I never had that. But when I had first put headphones on and walk down the street, I mean, it's hard for people to imagine now, but that was unbelievable to be walking along the street and hearing, by the standards of the day, very high quality music.
And your own it's like your own personal soundtrack, wasn't it? You were suddenly in the movie of your life.
Yes.
Mike, what was your favourite memories of that?
Oh, like Robert, I liked mixtapes, fantastic, you know. Home taping is killing music kind of thing, you know, but it didn't, did it? And it was absolutely fantastic. I remember putting one by the stage when I was playing in drums in some band at university, and it came out absolutely terrible sounding, but it was a bit of a thrill.
Oh. Anyway, on the podcast this week, because this isn't Music Weekly, this is, of course, Tech Weekly, we'll be dissecting the latest on the Google privacy wars as the Information Commissioner reopens the investigations into the search company's unauthorized collection of personal data whilst collecting details for its Street View service. This time, it's not just IP addresses they're alleged to have collected, but also the content of our emails. We're also finding out more about where the latest injection of cash towards broadband services in the UK will go. A whopping £530 million was earmarked in the spending review last week. Plus, another hardware announcement from Apple gets the blogosphere's juices a-flowing. There's so much to talk about, it's criminal that I'm still introducing the program. So let's get started with this week's Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Here's this week's news. Google Street View map service has stumbled along a rocky road since it was first rolled out across Europe. Recently, it was discovered that in the process of capturing the images that make up Street View, they also captured information about individuals' wireless networks, including their IP addresses. Inspired by new investigations in Germany and Canada this week, the UK Information Commissioner reopened their case against Google about alleged infringements of personal privacy, because it appears that even more personal information was collected than was in the sample of data that they had previously analysed. Not only were the IP details captured, but it has been reported that email addresses, the content of emails, and people's passwords were also recorded and stored. Mike, is this really anything that we should be worried about?
Well, obviously, all of this data is held on Google's server somewhere, so it's clearly up to the Privacy Commissioner to look at this more in depth. But I have to say, this is very much par for the course for Google. They do tend to operate on a basis of forgiveness rather than permission, in the sense that in wanting to organise the world's information, as is their want, they effectively suck up and hoover up everything they can get hold of, and then usually just turn around and go, oops, sorry about that, we caught you in the bath on Street View, or now we'll have to blank out faces, or now we'll have to dump the Wi-Fi details that we have on people. So it's very much kind of the way Google operates. And I do think also it does has a lot to do with their coming from their US heritage, where you can actually do quite a heck of a lot under American law. They don't have nearly quite the same sort of privacy issues or libel issues or any kind of sort of media law in quite the same way they do have in the UK or across Europe.
Now, this is something that, I mean, the privacy issues that we're talking about here is something that we've seen again and again when it comes to these large internet companies. I mean, a classic, of course, is Facebook. Mm. Mark Zuckerberg also seems to run with this idea that, you know, we'll take it, thank you very much, and then, oops, we'll say sorry later when people complain.
But then, in a way, to play devil's advocate, Facebook's shtick, as it were, is, you know, you've opted in. You've uploaded a profile, you've put your pictures on, you've put your mobile phone number into your profile page and shared it with your friends if you want to, and that's their get-out clause. The difference here is that I didn't really ask Google to drive past my house and check my Wi-Fi address and my email address and my password to my email and my password to everything else. So that's a different issue.
Now, Robert, do you use Street View?
Yes, I do. I use it constantly. I went past my own house.
Did you wave?
I was slightly shocked that my house, because I live in the middle of nowhere, so I don't live, you know, really little country lane, and they've been past our house. I know I wasn't there that day because my car wasn't there, but, you know, it is quite weird, spooky, because I use it all the time to go, especially when I'm, for instance, picking up people for carpool. I go, I want to know what their house looks like before I get there so I don't drive, you know, so you kind of have a vision of it. But, I mean, I think one of the key things in this is unsecured. I mean, that they were picking up information from unsecured Wi-Fi. Well, at my house in the country, I have an unsecured, an open Wi-Fi thing, because you can't get near enough the house. I've checked from the road. So I'm assuming they didn't get anything. But also, I wouldn't have an unsecured Wi-Fi hub in a city. And it's not a difficult thing. I mean, and I am not a professional nerd, you know, but I know how to do that. It's quite a simple thing. So they're only, if they were picking up my password and my emails and my everything from a secured network, because they knew how to hack into it as they drove past at 20 miles an hour, then I would think this is absolutely outrageous and wrong and they shouldn't be allowed. But from every report I've read, it says they picked up from unsecured networks, which just shows I wonder how many people's networks are unsecured. I just checked here. I'm on my iPhone, I'm picking up about 40 Wi-Fi signals, and all but one are secured. So they could have driven past here, they wouldn't have got anything. So I'm but just wondering, I mean, it's only because I heard a kind of Daily Mail rant, a story, I think it was on Radio 1, where they interviewed people in the streets, and everyone went, it's disgusting that they can do that. Well, actually, they didn't. And I think there's a big spin on this story, which I'm always suspicious of that thing, because who's saying it? It's very often the old media companies are saying, this is outrageous and Google should be shot. Well, they haven't actually done anything. If you've left your Wi-Fi wide open and you were sending an email and they picked it up by accident as they drove past, they would have got a tiny smidgen of stuff.
There's something in that, although, to be honest with you,
I don't think they should have done it. I mean,
All they needed to do was take some photographs. They didn't actually have to have equipment in the car that picked up Wi-Fi nodes. They didn't have to have that equipment.
Just, I mean, what was is the
photography
reason?
Is fine.
We should take from this that people probably aren't as educated about security as potentially they should be.
People aren't educated about security, full stop. They're still waking up to the fact that they're broadcasting their Facebook status update to the entire planet.
Yes,
most of the time.
I mean, I think that's you know, for me, that is a more. It's also the thing that worries me, particularly having teenagers, is that it doesn't go away. I mean, I saw, I was at Blogworld very briefly in Las Vegas last week, where someone did the demonstration where they, on one laptop, they deleted a photograph on Facebook, and on the other laptop, they found it again.
Yeah.
You know, it was within a few minutes.
And I don't bother deleting my tweets when I mistweet something, because I just think, well, you know, it's already been mirrored somewhere or whatever. So anyway, we'll keep on top of this story at guardian.co.uk/technology. Last week's comprehensive spending review in the UK outlined the coalition government's plans for funding public services, including the rollout of broadband services to the UK. Here's Chancellor George Osborne explaining what they have provisioned for.
We've also approached the BBC to ensure that they too make their contributions as a publicly funded organisation to savings during this spending review. And they will contribute to the £530 million we will spend over the next 4 years to bring superfast broadband to rural parts of our country that the private sector will take longer to reach. Pilots will go ahead in the Highlands and Islands, North Yorkshire, Cumbria and Herefordshire. All of this will help encourage the growth of our creative industries as a key part of the new economy we are seeking to build.
Mike, George Osborne identified a source of the funding as the BBC. Quite a chunk out of, you know, the licence fee is going to be going to this. What does this mean? How will this affect the broadcaster?
Obviously, the BBC's main role in life is to produce content and quality content at a public service level. Now, they may have to look at how they provision for that. I personally think that it's not entirely correctly headed, if that's a phrase. Technology will solve a lot of these broadband problems. You know, ADSL2 came along to replace ADSL1, and increasingly there are ways and means of getting much faster broadband that don't necessarily require taking huge chunks out of people's budgets and things like that. I think it's strange because, I mean, in a way, I mean, the BBC's content is increasingly heading towards digital. You know, the iPlayer has been a massive success. You know, so are they actually going to be able to have the money to create the content, which then people have to download at a broadband speed? And meanwhile, commercial ISPs are coming up with new and innovative ways. There's much more sort of talk now in the commercial sector about sharing lines to provision this kind of thing, and then basically the billing really becomes the competitive element, not whether or not you've got a physical cable to outside your door. You've actually seen this happen in the mobile world. T-Mobile and Orange now share their network. They're calling it something bizarre called Everything Everywhere, so they're sharing the network. And I think that commercial companies have moved towards this, and it's annoying slightly when government tries to put technical solutions over a commercial market, when meanwhile the commercial market is often innovating its way out of these kind of problems.
Robert, you mentioned before that you live in the country. So would this affect you? I mean, would
probably not where we live. We have had broadband now for probably only 3 or 4 years, and we're right at the very frayed end of the copper wire. You know, you can just about call it broadband, but I mean, it has made a big difference. I mean, everybody in the village has got it and uses it a lot.
So, given that, I mean, are you quite happy that the money is being diverted from?
It's really
the public
hard. I mean, I think I'm extremely unhappy about it. I mean, I think it's not what the BBC was intended to do, and I think it's not what people pay their licence fee for. You know, they're not thinking, oh well, we're paying this licence fee to build this infrastructure. Well, hang on a minute, that's not what we did. We thought we were paying for Blue Peter and the news. So, I mean, it is a very It's extraordinarily shoddy, dodgy bit of fairly sleazy Tory politics, basically. And I'm not the slightest bit surprised. I'm certainly not surprised by it. But it's a bunch of sort of two-bit salesmen who are pitching rubbish ideas and wearing rather nasty suits. And that's how I see the present government. And I'm not going to retract anything I've said.
Good,
they are scum. And that's fine. And I knew they'd do that. And they've been desperate to get the BBC for 20 years. They want to destroy it. They want to privatize it. They'll do anything they can, but they're going to market it to us in a really reasonable way. Everything they're doing to the BBC is sort of... I mean, the trouble is, defending the BBC is absolutely fraught. There are some people who work at the BBC who I would willingly see marched off a short pier. You know, they are really just the most appalling people. But... that said, the institution, I would defend the institution to the end, you know.
Well, more analysis of the CSR, and specifically the technological aspects of the CSR, are on guardian.co.uk. Finally in the news, Apple has announced a new piece of hardware, the latest in the lineup of the super sleek MacBook Air. But even more exciting than the shiny kit is the Lion operating system that will include an app store for the Mac. Now, taking a leaf out of his own book, CEO Steve Jobs described what sounds like a desktop and laptop version of the hugely successful app store for the iPhone, iPod, and iPad. But as Tech Weekly's Jemima Kish said on the PDA blog, in the future, quote, the app store might eventually be the only way to add software to your desktop computer. Great news for Apple, she says. Not so good for those who believe in having no walls to your garden. Is there no end to the rise of the app? End quote. Mike, what does this mean? What does Lion OS mean for the future of software delivery? Will we have no more high street?
Good point. Well, I think if you look at what happened with the mobile world, do you remember Palm Pilot and things like that? Trying to get a blooming app on your Palm Pilot effectively meant going to some obscure website somewhere, downloading onto your PC or your Mac, syncing it onto your Palm, or I mean, there are hardly any kind of PDAs back then, but anyway, some of them, and then putting it on. And what a nightmare. I mean, pain in the neck. And then suddenly Apple came along with the iPhone and put, you know, a few months after we actually launched, put this thing on the App Store. I mean, I just sat there downloading app after app after app. I mean, it must have gone absolutely crazy.
Absolutely crazy. Sorry,
Boom, boom. See what I did there? Anyway, so clearly, you know, with 250,000 plus apps on the iPhone App Store, they had a runaway success. It's quite clear that they can see that can do that again with desktop applications or applications which run on the laptop or the desktop, the proper Mac operating system. And fair enough, you know, go for it. You know, it's a free country and they can go for it. But obviously, they'll take their slice, their little tiny slice, but that ability to aggregate all these apps in one place, make it easy for people to download, absolutely fantastic, soar away idea. And the issue then is, are you going to get Apple to look at your app? You know, there's going to be an approval process again. And Steve Jobs famously said he doesn't want any porn on the application store for the iPhone or on the iPad. But I mean, heaven knows what will happen on the Mac OS. But applications developers, they may actually end up with, you know, more cash in their back pocket, as it were. At the moment, they have to do all of their own marketing. With an app store, it might make it a heck of a lot easier to get your app noticed.
Robert, we were talking about this before, about the idea that, in fact, this could be quite good for the bedroom coder, for the development scene.
I mean, the App Store as it is now certainly has made a huge difference. And I mean, I've actually met people who've you know, like normal people who don't work in a huge office, who've made apps that have been very successful and have been, you know, have launched sort of their careers in a way, which is, you know, and they couldn't, it would have been a minuscule bit of software if they'd done some sort of weird. I mean, the thing I think about is the early MP3 players. You could download a special player and you could give it a different skin and all those sort of things. And I mean, I have no idea what those things were now. I can't remember anything about them, but they were. And I remember downloading different MP3 players and then going, ooh, that plays an MP3 that I've just illegally downloaded. I didn't know it was illegal. But what would worry me is if you couldn't get software from somewhere else, like it in a sense, like the iPad. But you know, I install all sorts of weird little applications that help me on my desktop and on my laptop. Which might, if I couldn't get that, I mean, who knows? I might be able to get everything that I'd ever want through an app store, but that would make me slightly nervous that was the case.
Well, you can read up on all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. But before we move on, here's a heads up that we will be heading to Bradford soon, taking the program to the Bradford Animation Festival at the National Media Museum, which I have to say, an internet gallery is opening up soon. I think you're on the advisory panel as well.
Yes.
Anyway, Keith Stewart will be there talking to to the acclaimed director, Charles Cecil of Revolution Software, possibly the nicest man in the computer games industry. He's been involved in hits like Ship of Doom, Broken Sword, and more recently, Doctor Who, The Adventure Games. Keith will also be speaking with comic book author and journalist Kieran Gillen, whom I had a crush on at one point, I'm admitting now. He's written for loads of games magazines and is now working with Marvel Comics. And he'll also be speaking with Dan Pinchbeck, who's a lecturer in games at Portsmouth University. If you want to go, tickets are free. Find out how on this week's program page at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, or you can click the link that's on your iPod screens now. Now, also, before you stop listening, Tech Weekly is heading to Dublin on the 23rd of November. Web2 Ireland is kindly hosting Charles Arthur, Jemima Kish, and producer Scott Colley as part of its startup demo bar series. I, unfortunately, am otherwise engaged. They will be meeting the great and the good of Dublin's tech scene, finding out about standout startups and projects that deserve some special attention. If you or someone you know is technologically awesome and in Dublin, we want to know. So go to guardian.co.uk/media/PDA to let us know that you're coming and to record your interest. Well, enough about everything else. Now back to our special guest, Robert Llewellyn. Now, you're well known for your previous television exploits, of course, but now you're bringing your web video series Carpool to Dave TV.
What do the red double lines mean? Why are they different?
Oh, you can't stop on them. Even if you're like on fire and your bottom's fallen off, cannot stop there.
So double yellow's like don't park here.
Red is like, don't even look at it. But then what's that like in the bus stop?
The bus stop, poor bus is.
See, the bus
confused.
Can't stop.
What are you gonna do?
So you've got to run if you're waiting for the bus. He opens the doors, but he has to keep moving.
Yeah, just get on there. We used to have a bus driver, and this guy for years he would do this thing. People would go, "Thanks, driver," as they were getting off, and he would, without fail, every single time, go, "It's all right, I was coming this way anyway." And I'm talking about 10 times in the trip.
Where?
Every day.
That was Jason Manford, comedian and presenter of BBC's The One Show, sharing a car with Robert Llewellyn. Did he drive? Why did he not know the sort of basic rules of the road?
Now you say that, I'm suddenly thinking maybe he doesn't drive. I mean, I don't know. He wasn't driving that day.
Well, certainly not. See, this is the premise of the show, is that you drive.
Yes.
You effectively run a taxi service for your friends.
Yeah.
And family, and you then interview them. What was the inspiration for this program?
I wish I could remember. It really was I'd like to say a clever construction, but in fact it was a crumbling together of various aspects. So it's partly technical, that it's technically possible to do now because of the size of the cameras and the length of time they can record and how long the batteries last. I mean, even 10 years ago, you'd have to have a huge, great camera rig strapped to the outside of the car.
Which would obviously impede health and safety.
Yes,
would go crazy.
It may be made very dangerous for cyclists. And, you know, now the cameras are absolutely tiny, so they're sucker-mounted onto the windscreen. It's partly the car, because it's a very quiet car. I use a Toyota Prius. I don't have to pay the congestion charge, so when I take people to the broadcasting house, I don't have to pay. So there's a lot of those. But if only I had the wisdom and insight to go, this will work. I mean, it really was an experiment. And it was partly based on if I was going to try and do a super low-budget talk show, interview show, whatever you like to call it, in a studio, you know, then I'd have to get a camera crew and then I'd have to get the person to agree to come in for nothing.
And this, of course, means that you can
that
say...
That day I picked Jason up at his house and drove him to the BBC where he was to do The One Show. So he was going to do that journey anyway. So I just fit in with their itinerary. And I've done that with, I mean, I would say 85% of the journeys I've done are genuine lifts that people need. So I try and fit in with their logistics. Occasionally, we've driven around the block 5 times.
For no reason whatsoever. The magic of
wasting
web television.
Fossil fuel. Yeah, but the vast majority. I mean, when I did Jemima, I picked Jemima Kiss up here, took her back home. You know, so that was true. She had to do that journey anyway.
What kinds of tech do you use? Because you mentioned, you know, because of tech nowadays.
Yes. Well, I mean, part this is another part of that story is that we on Scrap Heap Challenge, the show I used to do for Channel 4, we used to call them suicide cameras. So they're tiny little bullet video cameras that we'd strap to a machine. And then they'd sort of be gaffer taped on, and then there'd be the box where the recording part was in a sort of safety box that was waterproof. But the actual camera itself, you'd often find them on a disused runway, just mashed up because they'd been driven over.
Fantastic.
So those cameras, and I got some secondhand ones of those, which are literally like a lipstick. They're absolutely minute, but they had, and they were sort of turn of the millennium tech. So they're not that, and so the picture quality wasn't that good, and the sound was a nightmare because you'd have to have lapel mics, which lapel mics and safety belts, really bad combination.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
I hadn't before it was too late. So there'd be someone saying something really interesting, and then they'd adjust their safety belt, right, really loud. So the newer cameras, then those cameras came out that are Sony cameras that are now, they're HC1s. But it's like a big fat lipstick, slightly bigger lipstick, but they have wide-angle lenses on. But then again, it's just the little camera, and then there's a wire to a box. But the quality of those, it's full HD. It's 1080p full HD with Dolby sound.
Well, how many cameras do you have in the car?
Well, in old-school Carpool 3, in Carpool Pro for Dave, 7.
You're a bit like a reverse Google Street View car. Ultimately, you're sort of looking in as opposed to looking out. Which is slightly disconcerting.
Yes, we could drive past your house and suck data out of your Wi-Fi network.
But no one would know
where you lived.
Which is probably quite convenient. That level of privacy is covered. But it is effectively a one-man show. I mean, you are taking all of this content and you're editing it?
Yes. I mean, not for the Dave series, because I did have some proper professionals to help me on that, which is very useful.
Because it does take quite a lot of time to have, three cameras.
Yes.
To just all that content to decide, best shots and all that.
Oh, no, it is. I mean, I have filled up 2 Drobos till you can actually see data dripping out of them. They're so jammed full. And hundreds of other hard drives. So, I mean, that's the thing I didn't realise when I first started was quite how much. So I started editing them on iMac, which did it very well, but rendering time got a little bit tiresome. I just time it so that I'd finish the edit and then set it to render and go to bed. So content management is something that I've learnt quite quickly, and I've made massive mistakes.
Well, but that's part of the whole process of learning to be a DIY media maker.
I've done 78 episodes on my own. And I got better at it. I got much, much faster. So I'm a real dab hand on Final Cut Pro. I'm very quick.
But what were some of the mistakes early on?
They were often in the recording process, technical mistakes. So only half of one microphone was working, and it was clipped on my seatbelt. So all you could hear is me going, really horrible, loud laugh. You couldn't hear the other person at all.
Yeah, we've done
so
that.
So some tragic mistakes like that. Yeah.
Now, I asked on Twitter for questions, and
right,
I got an absolute Drogo load, as you said there. One of my favorites, actually, Hanachronism, says, ask him whether celebrities essentially just use you as a free taxi. Is this something that you've thought about?
I don't think so. The only time that's been even close is a wonderful Dutch comedian called Hans Tuwon, and his PR people rang me up and said, can you pick him up at the airport?
Because we can't be bothered.
Yeah, and then, so I drove him to his, picked him up at the airport and drove him to his hotel. But he was very funny and extraordinary and very rude. I had to do some quite judicious editing with him. Yeah, but brilliant.
Well, here's another one from Miles Run. Is there a role for commissioners and channel editors now that you've cracked DIY television? In other words, what do you think of the whole sort of the media process, the media production process?
I think there still is. It is a mind-numbing process, and I don't think I used to get very moody and blame commissioners and go, they're all stupid, what do they know? But, I mean, there is a role for it still. I think what there might not be a role for is schedulers.
I'm curious about the lengths to which your geekery goes.
Right.
To what lengths does your geekery go?
I'm definitely an amateur geek. Certainly, I mean, I was very interested in very early on getting video on the internet and did try and set up a company in 2000 before YouTube to do that. So I'd learnt a lot about like video encoding and compression and those sort of tools quite early on. So that side of it I'm probably quite adept at. And I've actually had quite clever, proper editors and cameramen ask me questions. Ooh. Can't always answer them. But, because they don't, because they just deliver broadcast footage to a broadcaster and that's what they do. So that whole area of compression and reducing the size of a file is something that I've had quite a lot of experience with. But, I mean, everything else is very amateurish. I have got a lot of wires and plugs
They sort of adorn your wall. You just leave them as an art piece.
Boxes of them. And I'm just about to recycle some, you know, I'm trying to find a very good way of recycling a lot of old computer equipment.
So. Well, if you've got any suggestions, obviously, you're Bobby Lou on Twitter.
B-O-B-B-Y-L-L-E-W. That was from America. I worked with a woman called Bobby Sue. And so the crew called me Bobby Lou.
I like that.
I liked it. She didn't get it.
I do have one more question, and that's what came first, your interest in science and technology, because a lot of what you've done has been involved with, you know, whether it's Scrap Heap Challenge or any of the dramas or the comedies that you've done, have been very much about science and tech.
Yes.
Did you have that interest before, or did doing that kind of help you?
I did have that interest before. I mean, very much in when you were before you were born, and I was young, I was involved in alternative technology and low impact technology and sustainable technology, a big movement in the 1970s, partly inspired by the oil crisis of that period, and also the kind of hippie ethic of, you know, the whole world's going to like crumble, man, we've got to find a way, you know, which I like making fun of, but also has had an enormous influence, because that generation has that, you know, there would have been some drippy hippie bloke standing in a wet field when I was 17, who now runs one of the biggest wind turbine companies in the country. You know, so it has fed into the way we do things. And so things like that area of technology I was always interested in, and botching things together. I mean, I helped build a wind turbine in, I think, late 1972 on a farm in Wales, which generated electricity, and it was made out of an alternator from a truck and old bits of dust. And it was really rubbish. I mean, it really did look... It didn't even look as good as stuff they built on scrap heap. It did work, and it did light a very dull bulb in a kitchen of a farmhouse in Wales. It lit more than one bulb, but,
Of the dust. You can see the dust that you built. Wow, it's a kind of cyclical thing. Well, you can see the first episode of Carpool. I believe it's Thursday, the
4th of November.
4th of November on
8:30
Dave.
8:30 on Dave.
Excellent.
And then it will then be released in their full-length form on the internet later, when they finish with them.
And what about the unedited? Are you going to put all the unedited
up as well? It's been quite good fun, because we originally cut them down to 30 minutes, which is what they're going to be on the internet. And they were really good, and we went, oh. And then we had to find sort of 12 minutes out of that, which is what's on Dave. So it isn't the dross in the full-length one, it is more.
Exactly.
More good.
Extra more good.
Yeah.
Carpool, extra more good. Excellent. Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing that.
Thank you very much.
That's it for a Packed Tech Weekly for the 26th of October 2010. Many thanks to our special guests, Robert Llewellyn and Mike Butcher. Join us next week when the usual posse will be back in the studio. We'll be getting on the startup shuttle, and we'll be finding out about Kinect and Call of Duty. Thank you very much for listening. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.